Good morning, members. We're going to get our tax committee meeting started this morning. I'll call your attention first to the minutes that we have from February 2nd. Does anybody have any corrections or additions to those minutes? If not, if somebody would move the minutes from Representative David. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The minutes from February 2nd are approved. Members, the first item on our agenda is the House File 392 by Chair Lincheski, so I will turn it over to her at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'd like to move House File 392. And if I may, Mr. Chair, to get the bill in the order, I'd like it if I could also move the authors. Let me put my glasses on. 80392 DE3 amendment.
We have 392 before us as well as the DE3 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the best way to talk about the issue is just to talk a little bit about the process and kind of what we're about here. And if it's all right, Mr. Chair, after Ms. Kazoon and I finish speaking, it'd be nice if Mr. Michael can kind of get to the technical parts of what we're looking at here. For new members who have not served on this committee before, the tax committee historically has year after year, whenever the federal government acts during the break to change tax the tax code, the tax committee most years attempts to do what we call federally conform. Sometimes that's not successful, and often not everything is conformed to. An example would be the estate taxes. Year after year, we have not conformed to the estate tax. Another thing we have not conformed to year after year under both parties has been Section 179 expensing. So we don't always opt to do everything the federal government passes on to people in both tax cuts and tax check simplification. But we try to do as much as we can. These are usually tax benefits that are afforded Minnesotans of all different varieties, and it makes tax preparation much more simple for folks and administratively. So House File 392 is actually the language from the Department of Revenue working with the governor on their attempt to have kind of a two-part, a two-stage approach to federal conformity, recognizing that we have a deficit, but trying to deal with as many small or non-money items in conformity as we can early before a omnibus tax bill would attempt to address the rest, depending on what sort of revenue is available. And Ms. Kadoon could explain that. My amendment, what it does is actually steals from someone who knows this much better than I do, which is Mr. Michael, who has been working with all of us. We've invited minority members, majority members, and the Department of Revenue have attempted to have a conversation about how could we get to some federal conformity early in a non-revenue way, in a revenue-neutral way, so that the governor could actually sign the bill. So in that process, Mr. Michael, as he often does, has these light bulbs go off, and that light bulb, I guess, was Friday. And so he told me that on Friday we brought forward the DE3 amendment and also delivered it to Representative Broad and Mr. Stone so they could be aware of it and spoke with Ms. Kadoon about it. And so these are two attempts to try to address as much federal conformity as we can in a revenue-neutral way, in a timely way. If we wait until the end of the session and do it in the omnibus tax bill, of course, people will prepare their taxes wrong and then have to file amended returns, and of course, they'll be, you know, angry with all of us. So this allows tax preparers and people advising people, and people are already using TurboTax and getting their work done on their taxes right now, to be aware that the state has made the decision to conform to the provisions in what's being offered here. So, Mr. Chair, if you'd allow Ms. Kadoon to kind of talk about where she's at for the Department of Revenue, and then Mr. Michael could kind of explain both, that would be helpful. Thank you.
Representative Lincheski, Ms. Kadoon.
Hi. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Beth Kadoon. I'm Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Revenue. Thank you for hearing House File 392 today. As Representative Lincheski had mentioned, we have in front of us, in the governor's recommendation, was a federal conformity proposal as well, and that's included in your material. He, what was recommended as part of the Department of Revenue was really then a kind of a two-bill process, with the idea that we want to at least, if we can, address some issues early on in session just to provide some clarity to tax chairs, minimize confusion, and there's a few provisions such as a housing bond provision that Minnesota Housing Finance Agency is here to testify on, if you'd wish, on the need for really early passage dealing with their low-income housing mortgage program. And so we were looking at how we could pass a bill, and we really were with the goal that we had to minimize any cost to fiscal year 09 due to the budget situation. So that's why we came up with our version that was the original bill, which was really minimizing any cost to fiscal year 09 with the idea then that you'd have a fuller update bill in front of you for hopefully inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. So if there was an opportunity to do something earlier and help minimize confusion, make it simpler for taxpayers to file, that would be, I guess, a preference that we had, but we knew there was a cost concern, so it was how we could deal with that. I just want to step back a minute and just talk just briefly on why we really need to talk about federal conformity. Because, as you know, Minnesota's individual and corporate income tax is closely linked to federal definitions. For example, the federal taxable income is the starting point for Minnesota's individual income tax. And under current law, it's defined as federal taxable income as of February 2008. Well, since then, Congress has been busy, has passed four bills that really modify definitions relating to that. And so Minnesota doesn't automatically conform to those provisions when they change their definitions. You have to proactively change the law to do that. So that's why the past, I think, couple years at least, you've had to do an early federal conformity bill to adopt some provisions that are impacting the current filing season. So these would be ones that were impacting 2000 year tax year, which is what people are starting to file. And it really kind of kicks into high gear coming up probably mid-February is when most people will start making their individual income tax filings. And why we're strongly recommending federal conformity, it's really just the nuts and bolts issue on how you make sure taxpayers can comply with the tax laws and to ease taxpayer compliance burden. You reduce the cost of compliance both in time and dollars, both for the taxpayer and also for the department. And it also helps achieve a really key tax policy principle and the need to have an understandable tax system. The more complex the system is, the less understandable it becomes, and that can really lead to less voluntary tax compliance, both probably on the inadvertent mistakes as well as just that they don't want to bother if it just becomes too hard to do. I don't know if you want me to get into at all our original bill or... Mr. Chair, I think what might be best for just everybody, and I think Mr. Michael usually can get us enough of what we need without getting too into the weeds that we'll get into.
Okay.
And if that's okay, it would be nice if Mr. Michael could both describe the department's approach, and we have a bill summary for that, and then also what the D3 amendment attempts to do, so we can kind of think about them together.
Mr. Michael, you're up next in the batting order. If you want to cover both the original bill as well as the First Amendment.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll try to do that. I think Ms. Cadoon did a good job of describing conceptually what the bill has introduced proposes, and that essentially was to conform to as many of the items that are in the federal legislation that don't have a cost. And actually, it's probably best to step back and explain the conundrum that we're in here. And that's that over a five-year period of time, conforming to these federal changes, with a few omissions that we've done before, basically is very close to being revenue neutral. So it doesn't raise taxes and it doesn't cut taxes. On balance, it raises taxes. I think after the amendment that Nina's upstairs drafting now, it'll raise taxes by a few hundred thousand dollars. So for, all intents and purposes, it's revenue neutral. When you look at a five-year period, that's true. But the problem that we face is that most of the revenue loss occurs in 09. And, of course, with the unallotment and the budget situation, that's just not something that we can do. And so the difficulty that both the department had and the legislature, obviously, is to figure out how this can work so that we don't have a loss in fiscal 09. We're already at essentially zero after the unallotment process, but we can still conform as much as possible so we can realize those benefits that Ms. Cadoon was talking about, which is simpler filing, easier compliance and administration by the department, and so forth. The solution that the department came up with was to say, well, we'll conform on everything that doesn't cost money for 09 in this first bill, which will have the advantage of making filing simpler. We could get rid of this one form that's a real meddlesome form for taxpayers in the department that requires taxpayers to recompute their adjusted gross income because of all of these phase-outs and limitations and so forth. It would allow the Housing Finance Agency to issue their bonds in February, have them exempt from the alternative minimum tax and so forth. But the problem with that, the reason why that's not really, was not in the chair's mind when we were talking with the department about this, why that was not really an optimal solution, is that there's a bunch of other provisions that have costs to them. For example, the poster child for this is the IRA transfer. This provision, for some of you may be familiar with it, allows a person who's 70 and a half or older and is subject, therefore, to the minimum distribution rules under the IRA law to directly transfer money from their IRA to a charity and not count that as income to them. Under normal circumstances, they would have to take the distribution, recognize that as income, and then claim a charitable contribution for an item as an itemized deduction, or in Minnesota's case, as a non-itemizer deduction. There are big tax advantages to do that for some taxpayers because it may result in having them have less of their Social Security income subject to tax and their various other benefits to it. And so taxpayers made the decision back in 2008 to engage in this because federal law allowed it, we had allowed it in the past, and so forth. So if we went with this route of doing two bills, what we'd have to tell those taxpayers is either, as the chair suggested, file your amended return and go through whatever gymnastics it would take to recompute your age, to add this to your AGI, take it as an itemized deduction or a non-itemizer deduction and pay your tax. And then hopefully the legislature in May would pass a second bill and then you'd file an amended return and get the second dollop of tax benefits. Or alternatively, you would just tell those taxpayers, don't wait, file for an extension and file after the legislature passes this. This is also true for a bunch of other provisions like depreciation and various, for various kinds of business provisions as well. Actually a lot more of those, but there are probably more taxpayers with the IRA situation. And so, in general, we thought, hey, it would be much better if we could pass a permanent or a full conformity bill early so taxpayers would not have those headaches. And so the solution that we came up with, since a lot of these provisions benefit businesses, and because we sort of did a variation on this back in 2003, and this is now describing what the amendment does, is to say, we'll just direct the Department of Revenue in this filing season and largely in May and June to not pay out corporate tax refunds as fast as they otherwise would, so that when we get the extra revenue next biennium, they can pay them out in July and recognize them then. And that will offset the fact that people are paying slightly less tax in 2009. And so that's the solution to essentially make up the shortfall that we have in 2009 with the extra revenue that we will get under conformity in 10, 11, 12, and 13. And so essentially what the amendment says is to the commissioner, for the shortfall or for the mismatch in revenues that results from conformity in fiscal 9, hold back paying corporate franchise tax refunds enough so that we don't have a loss from this, and then pay them immediately in July as quickly as possible so the state doesn't incur interest. And there's a second, because that there's also an effect in the next biennium with the following biennium, because the final thing that makes this revenue neutral doesn't occur till fiscal 2013. They'll go through the same mechanism again. Now, hopefully, when all the dust settles in the omnibus tax bill, it may be that we can, find some way to say, hey, they don't have to go through that, because there will be other, Congress is right now passing another set of tax bills, some of which actually will have, if some of the provisions survive that are in there, may actually generate some more revenues, which may allow us to actually not do this. But that's the general idea and the concept, which is sort of convoluted and complex for that. Now, the precedent that we have for doing this before was in 2003, when I'm sure those of you who are around remember that we were in sort of a similar situation, not with federal conformity, but with the budget generally. And the legislature, at the request of the governor in that case, enacted a delay on the capital equipment sales tax refunds for sort of precisely the same purpose. And so the department paid those refunds out just a little bit more slowly, so that the losses or the cost of those refunds weren't recognized until the next fiscal year. And so this is just sort of, we thought, was a variation on that theme, which we did, I guess, 6 years ago now. And so that, I don't know, the other thing that we can do, and I can do it, or Mark Peterson from the department can do it, we can go, to the extent you want to go through these provisions and talk about the individual provisions that we're conforming on and not conforming on, we can go through that exercise. I mean, that traditionally we go through that exercise so that people know, but that's the sort of the general overview of the concept of what's going on here.
Mr. Michael, I don't know who wants to talk about, but I think it would be good to at least hit on those four items.
All right. I think probably and there's, because of discussions that occurred this morning shortly before the tax committee, there's a second amendment, which, as I said, Nina's upstairs drafting now, that will change this just a little bit, that relates to, she's here already, so I don't know, maybe Nina will want to go through these provisions. She knows it better than I do, but, with Mark Peterson's help, who's the attorney from the department who's done all the work for the department on this.
Well, Mr. Michael and Ms. Manzi, whoever wants to tackle that is fine with me, but let's start with the base and then go to the changes, so that members understand exactly where we're starting at, and then we can consider the proposed changes.
And I think, members of the committee, probably the simplest thing, as the chair indicated, rather than getting down into the weeds of all of this, is probably simpler to simply, on the bill summary overview, we can go through those bullet items that we're conforming to and the ones that we're not. And if anybody, the other thing that the department's revenue estimate has numbers, has all of the details on the provisions that they think will have a cost, and you can see the tally of that in the revenue estimate, which is the document that looks like this. But I guess I'll defer to Nina to go through the, sort of a quick run through of what's in the overview, and then if people have questions, we can try to answer those.
Ms. Andrews?
Mr. Chair, just so I know, having just come into the room, we're on the bill summary for the DE3 amendment, and you'd like me to discuss the DE3 amendment in general before we move on to the amendment that was just distributed.
And I'd also like you to back up just a tad and talk about the four items that were, we talked about the conformity, but the four items that we're doing differently on the Minnesota side, so that sets us up to talk about the DE3 and any subsequent changes we might have. So the educator expense credit, property tax, the second property tax, and those things. I don't know.
Okay,
maybe that's not.
So would you like, Mr. Chair, for me to take another step back and talk about the bill as introduced?
Yes.
No.
Okay, then I would like to maybe ask Mr. Peterson from the department to come up and join me.
Just briefly, so we have an idea of where we started, so members can follow this.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mark Peterson. I'm in charge of the Department of Revenue. Just go quickly through the bill that was originally introduced, which, in fact, there were maybe seven different bills that have been passed since the last time we did a federal update in February of 2008. And what we've done here is we've picked up the provisions of the first of those bills, which was a military a Heroes Earnings Assistance Relief Act. We picked those provisions up, and we picked up select provisions from the other bills. In the main provision in the Heroes bill was a provision that allowed for members of the military to claim a working or earned income credit and then subsequently the Minnesota working family credit using tax exempt combat pay as the basis for the credit. Other provisions that we picked up were the educator expense, $250 above line computation of adjusted gross income expense for K-12 teachers, a tuition deduction expense for college tuition paid for taxpayers, spouses, and dependents up to a $4,000 tuition, and a additional standard deduction for property taxes paid on non-commercial property of $500, $1,000 for a joint return. All three of those provisions are then added back separately in the computation of Minnesota tax for purposes of individual income tax, alternative tax, and also in the calculation of the property tax refund and the child and dependent care and education credit. Two other provisions that we pick up in this were provisions related to the issuance of bonds. One would allow treatment as a tax-exempt state or municipal bonds that are issued that are guaranteed by a federal home loan bank. And the other provision I'm picking up is the provision that would allow an exemption from the alternative minimum tax for certain bonds, the proceeds of which are issued for first-time home buyers for moderate-income housing and owner-occupied veterans benefits or benefits veterans' homes. And the final provision in the bill deals with withholding on differential pay to employees who have been called to active duty military. Some employers continue to make up the difference or some of the difference between the pay that they're getting in the military and the pay that they got in civilian life. We piggyback on the definition of wages for purposes of our wage withholding. That became effective January 1 of 2009 federally. We're recommending picking up that with the same effective date for state purposes because anecdotally we believe that a lot of the employers have been doing it anyways. However, you can't really impose a retroactive withholding burden, so in the next last section of the bill we have a provision that says we can't assess the employer's tax penalty or interest if they fail to withhold on wages before January 1 of 2010. And that's the bill is introduced.
Excellent, thank you. So now we'll talk about DE3.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in understanding how we got from the bill as introduced to the DE3, it may be useful to look at the Department of Revenue's estimate for the DE3 amendment. And if you look partway down the page, sort of in the middle, there's a line that says federal update net impact. And it shows for fiscal year 2009 a minus $14.795 million. But then as you look across to the right, all of the numbers in the subsequent fiscal years are positive. So the department took an approach in House Bill 392 where they conformed to things that they could afford to conform to and left out the things that added up to that $14.795 in this estimate. Some of the things that they didn't conform to in the bill as introduced are things that affect tax year 2008 and that would make it difficult for taxpayers in preparing their 2008 state returns to comply. Principal among these was an exclusion from income of transfers from an IRA or a Roth IRA to a charity of up to $100,000 per taxpayer. There also were several provisions related to expensing and depreciation and recognizing, for instance, recognizing of brownfield remediation costs, accelerated depreciation for business property on Indian reservations, and then straight line recovery for qualified leasehold and restaurant improvements. All of those things we had conformed to in past years, but all of those things cost money in fiscal 2009 for us to conform to. So the department, having no money to work with, left them out of their approach. But when we looked at that line going across and saw those positive numbers in later years, we met with representatives from the department, and Mr. Stone was there from Republican Research, and then other people, and we tried to think of a way to move money from fiscal 10 and 11 into fiscal 9 to offset that 14,795 and have this all work out. And we were trying to take it from the taxpayers who were affected. So it's just an advanced payment on the benefits of conformity that those taxpayers are going to get when filing their tax year 08 returns and when filing their returns in future years. And that is where this delay of corporate refunds came in, because that moves money on a one-time basis from fiscal 10 into fiscal 9 to offset that cost in fiscal 9. And then it makes another move from fiscal 12 to fiscal 11 to offset the resulting cost in that biennium. And you end up in fiscal 13 actually still gaining a small amount of revenue from this whole package. And you get to conform to all of this stuff prospectively going forward into the future without the one-year time limit. So that was the motivation behind the DE3 amendment. And if we go back to the bill summary, the overview gives you some detail on some of the particular things that are being conformed to in the DE3 amendment. There are several provisions in the HEROES Act that are related to members of the military. Principal among these is counting non-taxable combat pay as earned income for purposes of claiming the earned income credit and the working family credit. This is a provision that Congress has several times extended for 1 year at a time. I think that they wouldn't have so many people with combat pay, but now they have made it permanent, and so we would be conforming to it on a permanent and ongoing basis. The allowance of the direct transfers to charities from IRAs that I just mentioned, and that's effective for both tax years 2008 and 2009. Exclusion on a special rule, of the extension of the special rule for contributions of conservation properties by farmers and ranchers. Various provisions relating to depreciation and expensing, and this is not, many of you are familiar with Section 179 expensing. The federal government has not extended 179 expensing since the Minnesota legislature adjourned in May. They are expected to extend it and increase it in the stimulus bill now under consideration, but they haven't made any changes on that yet, so this bill doesn't address that at all. Then there also was a specially designated Midwestern disaster relief area that this bill would conform to, and also some special provisions related to national disaster relief areas. The changes that Minnesota would continue to not conform to are the ones that Mark detailed: the higher education tuition expenses, the teacher classroom expenses, the new additional standard deduction for property taxes paid, and also a deduction for qualified computer donations for corporations. The deduction for qualified computer donations by corporations is something Minnesota chose not to conform to for tax year 2007. So in preparing the DE3 amendment, the thinking was that, well, we didn't conform on the tuition expenses and the classroom expenses in 2007, and we're continuing to not conform on those. So we're going to continue to not conform on these qualified computer donations as well. And I'm not aware of anyone receiving any feedback on those in between last year and this year either, so that certainly made it easier to put them into the mix as something that we weren't conforming to. If you look through the summary, it provides you a little more detail on the things that we are conforming to. Section 3 of the bill is where the additions to taxable income are for individuals for the higher education tuition expenses and the teacher classroom expenses. Sections 4 and 5 make some conforming changes to federal changes related to an exclusion from subpart F income. Section 6 provides that certain preferred stock losses that were treated as ordinary losses at the federal level under the second Stimulus Act of 2008 are going to be treated as capital losses at the state level. When they're treated as ordinary losses rather than capital losses, the affected banks are allowed to move the losses toward the present. Treating them as capital losses limits the amount of loss they're allowed to recognize in each year and extends the time period over which the losses will be recognized, and that shows up in the revenue estimate. Section 7 and also Section 10 make conforming changes to the definition of federal adjusted gross income for purposes of things other than the regular income tax, for the alternative minimum tax, the household income definition used in determining the dependent care credit, the K-12 education credit, and in Section 9, the property tax, or Section 10, the property tax refund. Sections 8 and 9 add to household income for the refundable credits and the property tax refund the disallowed deductions for tuition expenses and educator expenses. This is something that probably should have happened in last year's tax bill but was overlooked. It's being picked up in this bill, but it's not being made retroactive to last year, but just prospective. Section 11 is sort of a technical update to the estate tax. Since there haven't been any substantive changes to the federal estate tax, we just like to keep all the dates moving forward and consistent. Section 12 is the provision that Mr. Peterson described relating to the withholding on differential pay. So that is just saying that for this sort of one-year transition period, we're not going to impose any penalties or interest as you get up to speed on exercising withholding on differential pay paid to employees who are called to active service. Section 13 is the section that delays the payment of corporate franchise tax refunds, first from fiscal 2009 to fiscal 2010 in the amount of $14.795 million. And then from fiscal 11 to fiscal 12 in the amount of $5.1 million. And those figures show up on the first page of the estimate down towards the bottom of where the numbers are, and that's what makes the numbers sort of get toward a zero for all the fiscal years and make the bill work fiscally. So that's the DE3 amendment.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Nancy. Representative Ronnie?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Manzi, could you explain this bullet that is included here called apportioning the exclusion of gain of the sale of an individual's principal residence? What was changed there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lanning, I'm going to... Oh, Mr. Michael is holding up his hand. I think he probably has the... He has the congressional materials on it and can do this a little more precisely than I can from memory, so I'll defer to him.
Always nice when someone volunteers. Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lanning, this relates to the Section 121 exclusion that I think people are most familiar with is the $500,000 and $250,000 exclusion on capital gain on your principal residence.
Mm-hmm.
As part of the Housing Act, Congress essentially cut back a little bit on the benefits of that exclusion as follows. There, and probably it's best to explain the behavior that taxpayers have been engaging in that caused them to do this. For people who own multiple residences, well, first of all, the rule on this is that if you were the owner and occupant of if the home was your principal residence for two out of the last 5 years, you can exclude capital gain of up to $250,000 for a single individual and $500,000 for a married joint filer. What taxpayers who had multiple residences were doing apparently, based on the congressional action, is they would, first of all, they would sell their regular principal residence and claim the capital gain exclusion. Then they would move into their second home, their vacation home typically, and occupy that home for the 2 years that's required, and then they could claim again another $500,000 exclusion on the capital gain. And it may be that they own both of these homes for 20 or 30 years, and so most of the capital gain on the second home was really attributable to the holding period when they weren't using it as their principal residence. So what this provision says is that starting in 2009, so it doesn't go retroactive and look back and say, well, let's look at how long you owned it after that, but holding periods after 2009 only include the time when you were, for the second residence, when you were occupying it as a principal residence. So, for example, if you had a vacation home for 10 years and then you moved into it and had the 2 year, met the 2 year requirement, you wouldn't get, you would get a proportionate amount of the exclusion, not the full exclusion. But it doesn't, it only is prospective going forward for holding periods after that. I don't know. It's a fairly complicated provision. I don't know if that helps you understand what's going on.
Representative Lennon, follow up?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. So after this year, starting going forward now from 2009, how long would you have to live in that second home before you get the full benefit like you've had retroactively in the past?
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lanning, you still have to live in the home for it has to be your principal residence for 2 years to qualify for the exclusion. All this is saying is that we're going to apportion the amount of the exclusion. So let's take an example where somebody immediately moves into their vacation home and begins to occupy it, and then they live in it for, well, actually that's not a good example. They live in it for 10 years or 2 years or whatever. They get the full exclusion in that case if they move into it right away in 2009. But let's take example number two. They don't do this until 2012, let's say, and then they live in it for 2 years and sell it. So what we've got is a four-year period here where the apportionment would apply, and they occupied it as their principal residence for 2 out of 4 years, so they'd only get half of the exclusion in that case. But it doesn't look back and say, well, you owned it for 10 years before 2009, and so we're going to count that period is sort of counted as when it was your principal residence.
Well, Mr. Chairman, this change is going to affect thousands and thousands of Minnesotans who own seasonal rec property, who at some point they were planning to move into that as their permanent residence, and this comes as a surprise. I didn't realize that this was a part of federal law that was recently changed.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure actually who this question goes to, but perhaps Mr. Michael. I thought in comments that were made, a number of $200,000 was presented as the impact of the kind of final amendment here about including educator expenses. And yet the governor's budget recommendation, that brief, talks about a number of $2 million. And then if I look at the actual amendment, it appears that there's a $3 million impact if I total up the refund delays. So I'm curious, what is the actual net impact, and are these numbers all kind of tied together somehow in a way that I'm just not seeing?
Mr. Michael or Ms. Manzi?
I can try to, Mr. Chairman, I'll try to respond to that. The reduction in income taxes as a result of, if this amendment were adopted to conform to to the educator expense allowance is $1 million per year for two tax years. So the net reduction in taxes would be $2 million. You're right that there's $3 million of shifting going on because we're shifting the same million twice in effect. So I think that's the confusion when you're just looking at the A2 amendment and seeing, well, there's there's $2 million, and then there's also a $1 million shift, and if you sum those all, you get $3 million. But it's the thing to keep your eye on is that it really would reduce state tax collections by $2 million, $1 million per each tax year that this would be effective for.
Just a quick follow-up, if I could. So then it also references to the extent, maximum extent possible, delaying the payment of those refunds. What kind of plays into your ability to pay the refunds or not, and who gets paid first, I guess, is another question.
Mr. Michael?
Chair, Representative Downey, that basically the Commissioner of Revenue and the Department of Revenue staff will have discretion on this, but I'm assuming that they will do it on a, you know, sort of a FIFO kind of basis to meet the first in, come first out, to meet the dollar amount that they need to. And I'm sure that they would manage it so that if they see, well, we've held refunds and now we're getting more claims for refunds, and so we don't need to hold those older refunds, they'll pay them. And the idea, and that would be consistent with, well, the other overriding thing that it says is try to do this in a way that you minimize the amount of interest that gets paid. Some of these refunds may relate to back tax years, which would then start to incur interest, and so I would think that they would try to pay those first, rather than ones that are filed for tax year 9 that won't incur interest. So, but the Revenue Department staff, I don't think the right Revenue staff are probably here to respond to how they would exactly do that. But
Representative Mulery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Michael, I hate to go back to this. The cabins, but if they, or so-called cabins, if they, let's say they had a 40-year holding period, and then they sell their regular house, move in there, so it's their homestead for 2 years, and then 2 years later sell it, what percentage of the gain then is receives that treatment? In essence, what do they get to consider as homestead exemption of their entire gain?
How much is that 250 or 500 reduced or considered now taxable?
Ms. Chair, Representative Mulery, I don't know that I have exactly enough facts to answer that, and I should have anticipated this would come up and prepared for it. But basically, if the holding period was all before 2009, and they moved in right away at the beginning of 2009, they wouldn't have any apportionment. The period after 2009's effective date that gets apportioned. So let's assume that, and that's why in my example that so let's say they had a 40-year period and then they waited until 2010 to move in, and so they had 1 year, the 2009 period. So it would be one over the denominator would be, you know, 42 or whatever in that case, or 43. And that's the percentage that would reduce it. So the grandfather, in effect, does the holding period before this became effective, doesn't count against you in a way. So it's going to take a long time before this is really going to affect taxpayers very much. And so in some ways, it's kind of surprising that they're, you know, showing that there's as big a cost on this as it is showing.
Right. Representative Dabney, then Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I believe this is a question for Mr. Michael. I'm looking at the federal update proposal document that we have under the Emergency Economic Stabilization Act of 2008 on page Well, it says page two, but it's about the third page in. I noticed one of the bullets is to extend the exclusion of discharges of principal residence acquisition indebtedness from the gross income of individuals. And as you know, Mr. Michael, tax is my second language, and I don't speak it fluently. In plain English, is this the treatment of homeowners who engage in a short sale and a certain amount of the debt is forgiven, and previously that was then a taxable experience, and now it is not a taxable experience?
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dabney, that's correct. This involves a case where I believe it's limited to principal residences again, but you have what's called cancellation of indebtedness income because the lender, well, in Minnesota, for example, when you do a mortgage foreclosure by advertisement, the lender has no ability to go after deficiency judgments to make you pay the difference between your outstanding loan and what they realized on the foreclosure sale. And so let's say, just again to use an example, where you have a $100,000 mortgage and the foreclosure sale nets them $80,000. In traditionally, that $20,000 gap would be regarded as income to you because you got a loan for $100,000 and they've now forgiven you that loan, and so you've got $20,000 better off. What this says is, if you meet the qualifications, that will not be income to you, and there are certain limits on, you know, who can qualify for this. This is an extension provision that we conformed to before, and I think Representative Mullery, for example, last time around had a bill specifically to conform on that provision because this is something that affects people who are in foreclosure.
Representative Dabney, Representative David.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To Mr. Michael, on the House Research Bill Summary, bullet point number two under the overview, conforming to allowance of direct transfers to charities from traditional IRAs and Roth IRAs for tax years 08 and 09. If you do that, is there a fiscal note that's been done on what that's going to cost the State Department of Revenue? Because if you're giving that money to a charity, And also, I guess, is that a tax deduction if I do that? If I take my IRA and I give it to the American Red Cross, what have I done?
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, Representative David, it's a good thing, I guess. But
I'm just a good guy. Yeah, just basically.
Relates to is, Under the law before this provision came into effect, and this only applies to people who are 70 years old, 70 and a half and older, and are therefore required to take what are called minimum distributions. And what this law allows is it says you can just have your, you know, let's say you have your IRA with, you know, with the Lanesboro Bank. You can have the Lanesboro Bank make a transfer to the Red Cross of $10,000 or $50,000 or whatever. Under the old rules, that was not allowed. If you had done that, it would have said you have income and you have to report that as income. And then when you get down the form to the itemized deductions, you could take an itemized deductions for a charitable contribution. This is tax advantageous to taxpayers because keeping it out of your income altogether means that other provisions of the tax law will not adversely affect you. For example, taxpayers who receive Social Security income and have income over $25,000 or over, you know, $43,000, I forget where the thresholds are exactly, and they vary by filing status, you have to then start reporting some of your Social Security benefits as taxable income. So if you had to include this IRA distribution in your income, more of your Social Security income would be subject to tax. And there are also all sorts of other phase-out rules that apply on various other provisions. And so basically what this allows the taxpayer to do is to keep this totally out of their income. So you can't deduct it because otherwise you'd be not only keeping it out of income, but you'd be reducing other income. So you don't claim a deduction for this, you just don't report it as income. And it should actually not have any cost to the state of doing this, and it will save a headache of requiring taxpayers, if we don't conform, to recompute their income for Minnesota purposes and then take the deduction and pay more tax.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Michael, there has to be a cost to the state, because normally if I would take my RMD, I would report that as income, pay my tax on it. Now I'm getting by with not having to report that as income. It has to cost the state, except in 2009, where they said you don't have to do RMDs, which I'm somewhat perplexed about and don't quite understand, but it has to cost the state money if I would take my RMD and pay my taxes on it versus giving it to the American Red Cross or some other worthy charity, and that I don't have to report as income before I did. So there has to be a cost to the state. And the other question is on RMDs, because of the federal government saying you don't have to do RMDs for 2009, what's that going to cost the state? I mean, that's the time when the government should just be happy as can be. You're over 70 and a half. Now you have to take money. You have to pay taxes on it. Now you don't have to.
Right. Representative, let staff catch up. Mr. Michaels?
Mr. Chairman, Representative David, yes, there is. When I was saying there isn't a cost to the state, I was talking about the administrative cost. If you look on page 3 of the Revenue Department's revenue estimate, where it says about middle of the way down through the page in bold type, extension of individual income tax provisions, that's where the tax cost, the reduction in tax of this shows up, and it is a $1.3 million cost in 2009 and a $1.25 million cost in 2010. We will collect less tax as a result of this, and those are the numbers that show up, and that's why we had to engage in these other changes to offset that cost, so taxpayers would not have to essentially filed differently in 2009.
Well,
but in terms of administrative costs, there will result in administrative cost savings.
And then, Mr. Chair, Mr. Michael, I guess there wouldn't be any change if you gave a Roth, if you did a direct transfer of a Roth, but there would be of a traditional. So.
Right.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Davis, I can't imagine anyone doing a Roth transfer. That would make no economic sense.
I'm sure, Representative, you'll have emails when you get back to your office. But willing recipient. It's Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got two quick questions for Mr. Michael and then more of a process question for Representative Lincheski. The quick questions are, I'm looking at the DE3 explanation of the proposal, and it talks about temporary relief for Kiowa County, Kansas, and I'm wondering why there would even be a remote cost, negligible cost. Why is there a zero? Why isn't there eight zeros there related to that? And then my second question is, can you just explain this limitation on excess farming losses? I'm not sure what that actually is.
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, on the cost of the disaster, that I'll defer to the Department of Revenue to explain that. Now, it's always possible if you have Minnesota taxpayers with property in Kansas and so forth, but I think it's the methodology assumption that's involved there.
Mr. Michael, welcome.
Sir? Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Paul Wilson from the Department of Revenue. There do tend to be not only some Minnesota residents with property, but also you do have non-residents who pay Minnesota income tax, and so it's because of those two things that you can get some impact. The details on exactly why the numbers come out to be the size they are is something I can get back to you on. But that's why there can be an impact. You don't have to be you can be a Minnesota resident and have property there, or you can be a non-resident who has property with filing in Minnesota and their income will be lower. So the apportionment could actually reduce their income tax as well.
Thank you. I just, it's interesting to put into our statute something for Kiowa County, Kansas, and I think it might raise some red flags whether there's folks who have property or not. But the second question was just related to the excess farming losses. I don't know, Mr. Wilson, if that's yours too or if that's Mr. Michael's. Or
Dr. Wilson, you're looking at Mr. Michael.
He's
looking back to Ms. Manzi.
Mr. Chair, my recollection of this, other than the $300,000 amount, was not very good, and so I think Ms. Manzi may be better able to respond to this.
Ms. Manzi?
Mr. Chair, Representative Brad, I actually anticipated your questions and scrawled some notes on some orange post-it notes about what this is. It only applies to taxpayers who take direct or counter-cyclical payments under the Food Conservation and Energy Act of 2008. So it's going to be people receiving federal payments or people who have any commodity credit corporation loan, and I will admit that that's all I know about those things. I can find out more if you'd like, but I assume those mean something to people who are farmers. If you're one of those people, then the excess loss amount equals your deductions for the year minus your gross income for the year, but your gross income is increased over a threshold level. And the threshold is the greater of $300,000 or the amount by which your gross income for the last 5 years exceeded your deduction. So it's the greater of those two things. So if you had a lot of income in excess of deductions for the last 5 years, it could be higher than the $300,000. But otherwise, it would be your losses in excess of $300,000.
Clear that up.
Yeah.
Representative
Brock. Mr. Chairman, thank you, Ms. Manzi. Can you just boil it down, maybe not today, but at some point in a simple way, of how many people this actually impacts? That might help.
And that will be a question I'll be consulting with Dr. Wilson on, because I assume that they may have gotten some information from Congress on the number of people expected to be affected by this nationally, and then would have some way of attempting to apportion that to Minnesota.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I don't need that right now. I'm just curious how many people are in this specific situation. And then my last question is a series of questions, so actually just one for Representative Lintesky, and I don't know if you'd prefer that I hold that question.
No, actually, I think it'd be nice to have Chair Lintesky back up so we can move DE3 and A1. Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Lintesky, I'm just trying to understand process. Typical process with these bills is that they're worked on, as you have done with the department and with the governor's office, and they're, for the most part, non-controversial, and they kind of fly through with blazing speed. And so I'm wondering, in terms of the amendments that you're bringing forward, what the position is of the governor's office and the department, and how, I guess not only those two, but also the Senate. I'm just curious how this is going to all fit together.
Chair Winchowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Brad. I don't have a clue on the Senate, so I'll be straight up on that and hope to convince Chairman Bach that conformity is very important. And I think, you know, nothing against the Senate, but the House, bipartisanly, in the time I've been here, has taken its sort of responsibility to conformity a little more seriously. And since the bills have to originate here, I mean, that might be why. But Ms. Kadoon, I think, could, you know, talk about where the governor may or may not be. He hasn't told me one way or another, but I think, and maybe she can join me to help answer that question. But what I would say is, I think the problem here on the process is the issue that you raised, Representative Broad, is in general, you know, we try to make these non-controversial, and just kind of everyone goes, okay, yep, let's do that. And when you have money, it's pretty easy. I mean, you know, as we all know, we've passed bills in the past where we conform to all these things, that pass all these tax benefits on to people, and as the discussion here that's happened, I think Representative David's comments highlight, you know, this is a tax benefit for somebody in the situation he was talking about, and if we don't conform, we're keeping people from getting those tax cuts, is really what it is. It's the cost of the state on the revenue side. It's really passing on tax benefits to Minnesotans. And so we've tried to, when we have, you know, money, to just conform to whatever we can. And there have been these big ones that are very expensive that we have not conformed to bipartisanly. The problem that we're in today is it's harder to do a non-controversial situation, as Mr. Michael explained. If he called it a conundrum, I thought that was generous. you know, yes, it's a shift. I mean, that's the problem. You're kind of taking money in the future that the passage of conformity will give you that revenue. And moving it into 09 so that Chair Solberg and the governor and others can get a revenue-neutral solution so that Minnesotans are going to be afforded these tax benefits they're going to receive as a result of conforming. Much of it is to businesses and much of it is to individuals, but we're all kind of stuck in this box of what do you call it and how do you do it and how do you time it. And so you could pejoratively say, you know, this is a shift. I mean, this is the really bad, this is the beginning of the shift, you know. And that would be accurate. On the other hand, you could say, no, this is sort of a down payment on the tax benefit you're going to get later. And that would be accurate. So I think, you know, we're all able to do the rhetoric on both sides. It's really, I think, honestly been the most difficult I've seen this year. And I watched Chair Krenke and Chair Abrams try to do it because we have this massive deficit and we're trying to take money that we're going to get later and move it to today so we can have a revenue-neutral solution so we can get more permanent conformity. So I think the process part is problematic, and I respect that. But I wouldn't speak for the governor or the Department of Revenue on where they might be.
Ms. Cadu?
For the governor's budget, as I mentioned earlier, he did have federal conformity as part of his budget. But in his budget, he allowed for a revenue decrease that would occur of $6 million in 10 and 11, and then a revenue increase of 12 and 13 of about $7.5 million. So I do not know and cannot speak for the governor on if it would be an acceptable revenue-raising tool to use for the corporate refund. I do not know what his point of view will be on that. From the Department of Revenue's perspective, obviously, we'll take our clues from how the governor will react to this situation. And I can just say that when we're looking through kind of the various options that were out there for the ability to pass the bill early, and to allow for the cost to be taken into account to make it revenue neutral for our current fiscal year of 09. This is probably one of the least objectionable revenue-raising tools that we've discussed. And with the idea also as well is that a lot of the benefits in the current federal conformity bill, a lot of them do accrue to corporations. To me, it also made a little more policy sense that if you look at that, then at that point, that maybe corporate refunds, like I said, is kind of the more least objectionable tool, as well as in the sense is that you're not permanently raising any of these taxes. What you are doing is you're holding on to refunds, as Joel Michael actually pointed out, is probably how the Department of Revenue would have to administer it, which is you hold them on to a hopefully a small point. Time period, and then you release them, kind of that first in, first out type of concept at the time that you're also trying to minimize any interest costs that would accrue.
Okay. Representative Broad.
Thank you. And Representative Winchesky, I appreciate the difficulty and was not trying to engage in rhetoric, or I probably would have used more flamboyant words, but. What I'm trying to figure out is how do we actually get something moving in a way that is acceptable and workable and signable, and in a way that helps taxpayers. And when I look at the federal process, and I think it was Mr. Michael who said that there's something happening on the federal level, a tax bill that might impact us yet again within this session, it seems to me that maybe we ought to be looking at a two-step approach that was originally proposed. Let's do the pieces that we can do now that don't cost money, that impact folks positively, but that don't open us up to what my concern is that, you know, businesses are struggling the way it is to provide jobs for people. And whether the benefit goes to one or the other, the difficulty of law changes continually is something that businesses are always facing and dealing with. And, you know, we're going to say we're going to give it to you over here, but we're going to take it away over here. It seems to me that it's net-net loss. And so I'm concerned about that. I don't know what the answer is. But my question to you is, if the federal government passes something, are you looking at potentially coming back and doing an additional conformity bill later in session? I'm just trying to understand how that all interacts going forward as well.
Chairman Chesky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Broad. Well, I think we have to still continue to touch on conformity if we're, you know, no matter what we do here today, because the governor has proposed conformity in his budget. And I think he didn't have the conundrum because he didn't have to deal with the timing issue. He was able to just put it in the budget proposal. And I think that's a great sign, honestly. I mean, the governor just paid for compliance in his proposal. And we'll see that when the commissioner, I think, is here tomorrow, to walk through the governor's rec. But, you know, he doesn't have to deal with it immediately here and now.
I do think on the Senate side that we, by the House showing that it's committed to conformity, makes the Senate move. I mean, I think, you know, that's one of the pieces of leverage. The House gets out of this kind of situation, no matter which party's in control. Is until the House moves on conformity, the Senate really doesn't need to. But, you know, I think we're going to have to deal with additional issues if anything that President Obama is doing happens, you know, and it's signed. I can't imagine we're not going to, you know, have to deal with that. I think right now he's proposing income tax cuts for 95% of Americans through the withholding tables. And so I haven't figured out yet exactly how that works, but I think whether we as a Minnesota legislature, sometimes you hear members say we should decouple and just work off AGI, and I think there's a lot of merit to that. That still doesn't get out of this yearly federal conformity issue. So I think no matter how we set up our state income tax system, whether it's federal taxable income or adjusted gross income, we're always going to have, no matter who's sitting around this table, these federal conformity issues when Congress acts. So I do think we're going to look at more again later. Yes.
I just have one last follow-up. I have a bill that repeals the income tax, and so maybe that would help us get out of these conformity discussions in one way. Second, you know, the rhetoric. thank you, Representative Cole. In terms of process and paying for things and targets and things along those lines, why couldn't the majority in the House build the costs of some of these things into the budget versus requiring the shift now? Is there a technical reason why that isn't something that could be done?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Broad. I think the problem is for people filing today, here and now, tax preparers, what is the software? It's a timing issue for Minnesotans. We could just build into the budget, and we could, in fact, change the law, and then everybody have to go back and amend their returns. So the timing issue really only benefits the taxpayers. The political entities around here, I don't think, could do it either way. But we would have, as I think Mr. Michael, when he was walking through the issue, you have, you know, the overwhelming majority of Minnesotans then filing their taxes wrong. And to get the benefit, say, that Representative Davis was talking about, then they have to go back later, file an amended return, where this way, as they move over either through a software package or their preparer, who's never even showing it to them, just bringing it in for the signature, they're receiving that tax benefit, that company or that individual, just sort of just automatically.
Right. Mr. Chairman, I wasn't going to have another question, but I think I'm not suggesting delaying the conformity. What I'm talking about is essentially paying for it within the budget cycle, as opposed to passing the dollars that go with it. So why can't you pass the conformity and build that? Actually, this is a great question for Solberg, but why can't you pass it now, give the benefit to the taxpayers, and pay for it within the budget that we'll be passing at some point, I would expect?
Well, you could do anything you want. Well, you could increase the deficit more and more and just do away with income tax and increase the deficit more and more. But the ghost of Representative Wiggum is in the room with me today. And that is
he dead?
No. he's live and well, and he taught me very well that every amendment that he had, he paid for it within the target. And I think that we need to do that.
Chairman Chesky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Broad. The other thing, and Mr. Michael said this too, and you know, we all know it's so hard to get everything in here, right? Because we all just have watched this debate today, and we all know we don't understand all this, right? I mean, there's none of us who understand all this, and that's why the staff has to keep us, you know, wading through it. But remember, the cost of this would be in 2009, and the revenue would come forward. So we just went through an allotment in December. I think most people think the February forecast is going to show another 2009 deficit. And so already we're going to have to solve, you know, probably the governor won a lot again, my guess is. But we have the cost in 2009, so it either grows the response to the legislature to fill in a bigger deficit in just this year, or the governor would have to unallot more. And so my guess is if I did that in a bill form, I think the governor would veto that pretty quickly. So it was an attempt to kind of move the pieces around for signature, knowing that we all probably want the same thing in the end, but we're just hitting a timing issue right now, really. And I think that's what I was referencing, that
I've never seen that problem since I've been here.
Representative Coles, and then we'll ask the chair to move DE3 and A1. Representative Coles.
I think we've kind of beat this horse to death, but I just want to make sure I haven't missed a memo from the chair of the Ways and Means Committee or from the chair. I wasn't aware that the committee had a target yet. Maybe I missed something, but I thought that's what you referenced,
Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, we do not have a formal target yet, but it's a good policy.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Goldberg, I couldn't agree more. I think we ought to get a target to the committee as quick as possible, even if it's subject to change down the line.
Representative David, quick question.
Yeah, real quick here, and thank you, Mr. Chairman. To Mr. Michael, I see on page 3 here that we take care of the numbers for the tax varied distributions of, you know, the RMDs for people over 70 and a half. Have you taken into account how much will be short because President Bush said you don't have to take RMDs for 2009? Is that factored in? And then after that, are we talking at all about is there any talk about people that have lost their jobs before being able to take distributions before 59 and a half without the 10% IRS penalty?
Yeah. I see Dr. Wilson coming up as well to answer this question. But Ms. Michaels, if you've got it.
Maybe I'll respond to it. I just got a question passed to me. What is an RMD? And that's, so I'll answer it, not to be confused with a WMD, but it's...
I never found any of those, so
that acronym for members of the committee refers to required minimum distributions. And essentially, people with retirement plans, once they reach age 70 and a half, are by federal law required to start taking the money out. And as Representative David indicated, the law was changed for, there's a holiday on this for tax year 09. Now, the thing about that is that that's not really a conformity issue, but it will be a forecast adjustment. But Dr. Wilson can better talk to that than I
can. Dr. Wilson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Davis, yes. I just wanted to point out that it will be in the forecast. The forecast, the Department of Minnesota Management and Budget, I guess now, is looking at that issue, and we'll make an adjustment in the forecast for that revenue. But there's nothing we can do to avoid that. It's not a conformity issue for us. It's just going to happen regardless of what's done with a bill like this.
And Mr. Chairman, Mr. Michael, for my 59 and a half question, I'll talk about that later.
All right. Thank you, Representative David. Chairman Chester, do you want to move A1?
Yes, I'd like to renew my motion for the DE3 amendment.
And A1 as well?
Oh, and I guess I have to first move this. I can't amend the amendment to the amendment.
Right. So we've got DE3. How about, do you want to move A1?
But I don't, Mr. Chair, I don't think we voted on the DE3.
No.
I don't have this amendment that I'm being told about here. Thank you. Well, okay, so I'm not sure what the confusion is. I know we have a technical amendment to it, and I don't have that. Oh. I think the DE3 has to be voted on first, doesn't it?
Okay. Number 20, A1 is an amendment to DE3.
I'll move the eight. I can't read it.
The amendment, right. So we vote on A1 first. That's where I was at.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the 80392A1 amendment to the DE3 amendment.
All right. Thank you. So, members, we've got 80392A1 before us, which deals with the dates, cleaning up some date issues.
No.
For discussion on that, seeing none, a procedural vote, all those in favor of A1 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? A1 passes and passes. Representative Mullery, do you want to move A2?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move the 392A2 amendment then.
Okay. Members, discussion on A2. Seeing none, let's proceed to the vote. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? A2 passes as well. So members, now we're on DE3 as amended by A1 and A2. Discussion on the... Representative Leonard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Michael, I want to make sure that I'm understanding the proportioning of the exclusion gain correctly. I don't think this only affects seasonal rec. I think it affects people who move from city to city after 2 years. They have an exemption on their capital gains as well. And the way I read this is that this provision, in effect, raises capital gains taxes on those people who are affected by this change.
Thank you, Representative.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lanning, you're correct in that this does not, it really doesn't relate to the seasonal rec property per se. What it relates to is people who own two residences and move essentially into one from one into the other, and they have a holding period. But, you know, if you essentially just sell your house and move to another house because your job changed or something like that, it will not affect that. It's essentially what this says is it says when you owned a second home and then you move into it later, it's taxed on that holding period after 2008 in calculating the exclusion. So the normal circumstances, you know, if I were to move from Minnesota to Massachusetts and buy a house in Massachusetts, I would, and move into it, it's, you know, that it would not affect that in any way. It's just when you own two homes at the same time and then subsequently qualify for the exclusion on the second one, that it tacks on some of that, or it takes away, or portions away some of that holding period. But you are correct that this, because this takes away an exemption in current law that people can benefit from, there will be some people that will pay higher capital gain taxes as a result of that. That's the reason why the numbers in the revenue estimate appear positive.
Thank you for the clarification.
Representative, thank you. Members, any other discussion on DE3? Is there any public input on DE3? Seeing none, members, let's vote on DE3 as amended. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
DE3 passes. Members, we need to then proceed to House File 392 as amended. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
392 passes and will be referred to Ways and Means as amended. And we are adjourned.
Thank you. Thank you.